This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The technological revolution has rearranged just about every profession and sector. Students go to college to prepare to enter this new workforce, and as they do, you would think our institutions of higher learning would have changed dramatically as well. No, not indeed. Indeed not. Kathy Davidson says they haven't, or at least not enough. She has been an educator at Michigan State, Princeton, Duke, and now City University of New York. And she believes our system of higher education is obsolete and needs an overhaul. And she has a few ideas about how to do it. She's written a book called The New Education, How to Revolutionize the University to Prepare Students for a World in Flux. Kathy Davidson, welcome back.
So good to be back.
Good to have you here. Now, talk about this book, because I know this is a lifelong passion of yours, how to reorganize higher education.
Well, you know, lots of things that are interesting are happening around the peripheries of higher education. There are wonderful programs and wonderful professors everywhere. The problem is that the structure we've inherited was invented for the industrial age, for the age of the Model T and the assembly line. And even our hierarchies and our ranking system, our accreditation system, still supports that system. So it's hard to change when you're being judged against a system that was invented over 100 years ago.
Well, what is it about that system? I mean, look, we have these departments, we have specialties. That's good. It allows us to focus on particular areas, chemistry, physics, the humanities. But you're saying that those silos now are just no longer helpful for what we're trying to do.
They don't match very well with the world we're living in. They were invented as professions were being designed and developed. People often say the higher education hasn't changed since Socrates walked across the floor of the academy. That's so not true. Between about 1860 and 1925 in America, people really set about saying, how does this new world of industrialization, how do people get educated for this world? And they invented law school, professional schools, nursing schools, business schools, medical, graduate school. Most people don't realize those are new. Credit hours, grades. These are things that we think of were always there. No, they were invented for a very specific time. Our times have changed. So I heard yesterday from a counselor that about 10% of students actually go into a profession that maps on to what they majored in college. So that leaves out 90% of students. And many of the most interesting programs, in fact, span disciplines, span professional schools and arts and letters, span sciences and social sciences, divisions which were made for the last big reform movement in higher education, again, at the turn into the 20th century.
So does this really require a revolution, or can schools just be a little bit more mindful and intentional about interdisciplinary programs?
If they're willing to take the periphery and actually do an involution where what's at the outside becomes the center, and they don't think that's revolutionary, then that's fine. I'm not concerned about the word we use. For most universities, that would be pretty revolutionary. Because one of the things is it means going against accreditation systems. Hampshire College, a progressive college and founded in the 1970s in Massachusetts, did something about 5 years ago. It said to realign its mission. They abolished the keeping of any records about SAT or ACT scores. Now, they said they had been discounting those scores for a long time, but now they don't even keep the data. What that means is they could no longer be in the U.S. News and World Report rankings. That means they took a huge risk of no longer being visible in ranking systems. They even had to work with local Northeastern accreditation systems about could they be accredited because they don't use SAT scores. Most people have no idea that those things are linked together and how serious it is and how hard it is to make those changes.
Give us a blueprint of what your system would look like and, again, what accountability would look like under that system.
So I think all the things that changed between 1860 and 1965 give us a good blueprint of what has to change. And they have to be changing on that level from the classroom and how we teach our individual students. And that can change tomorrow. Most teachers can change the way they teach tomorrow, all the way up into how we finance higher education, whether it's private education, through corporate funds, through huge endowments, through this kind of escalating competition over who has the most facilities on their campus, to even more seriously, public funding of higher education, which is in dire, dire straits right now.
So, and again, does this mean that we need, I mean, should those buildings still be there? Or are we talking about a kind of interdisciplinary approach that doesn't even require a university and an English class and a physics program and a chemistry program?
I think you can do a lot within those buildings and outside them.
Mm-hmm.
I taught one great class at Duke one time where my students had to do ethnographies, not by departments, not by fields, but by buildings. They had to talk to the housekeepers. They talked to the janitorial staff who was there at night. They talked to everybody who walked in and out the building. They were shocked to find out people in different departments who were in the same building, sometimes in the same hallway, did not even know each other's names. You know, we're so siloed and so divided. Now, that makes no sense to me. The universities I studied that and the people I met who are doing the most interesting things ask big, complicated questions. At Arizona State University, there's a new school in art, design, and engineering, where each year the first-year students, just as they're entering, have to deal with a huge problem. One of my favorites was one year the question they were told to ask was, what will life be like in Phoenix when there's no more water? Now, that's a question that every student entering can feel because there's almost no more water. But to answer the question, the students then had to map their way through the curriculum. So instead of a smorgasbord of general education courses, everything was, how do we answer that question? Who's going to be affected? How does water systems work? Where do we get our water systems from? How much does it cost? Who will be served and who won't be served? What are the ethics of water distribution? What are the ethics of clean water? What if we privatize water? You know, there are many different questions that aren't just about the science of hydrology, but the ethics of hydrology. That's an amazing way to get an education. It's an amazing way to begin college because it told them their first year of college. College, the importance of college is to learn deeply, to think deeply, but also to think about how what I'm being educated in can help my society, help the world I'm living in. Not just help me, but the world I'm living in, since I don't know too many humans who live outside the world. This is the world we got.
I know a few, but I'm not going to name them here. Here's the thing, though. So what that model suggests to me is certainly a breeding critical thinkers, people who are asking themselves questions that then require a lot of experts to help them understand more deeply, A, what the problem is, B, what the consequences of not solving it are, and C, you know, how we can fix this. It does require for them, for those students, somewhere a repository of experts.
Absolutely.
And the university is pretty good at least making those, right? Even in that siloed system, we've got the experts at this moment to go to ask those kind of questions.
Totally. I think universities do a great job at supporting expertise among their faculty. We do a very poor job of teaching students not how to emulate an expert, not how to hear an expert, not how to learn what the expert knows, but how to become experts themselves. The fancy word for this is metacognition, where you don't just learn a fact, you learn how you learned the fact. What part of that fact has meaning for you? What part of that fact can you apply to other things in your life? We know that simply studying for an exam means that you learn that content for the exam and you forget it very, very quickly. There's a famous case, and I've been asked by this prep school not to use their name anymore, so I won't, but one of the top five prep schools in America about 4 years ago did a pretty mean thing but a brilliant thing. They had every student on their first day of class in September retake the exact same exams that very student had taken in May, well, before they left. Now, this is an incredibly expensive, fancy prep school. The average grade in May on final exams across all subjects of all the students that were tested was 92. The average grade of those exact same students retaking tests that they themselves had taken in May was not even 60%.
Wow.
Now, the school was freaked out. I actually said if I had been there, I would have said, wait, what you've taught students is if they have a challenge equivalent to a final exam, they can work their tails off and they can do great in that challenge. But they also have to be aware that they have to keep renewing that learning. The phrase that's often used is learning how to learn.
Right.
It's the most important skill any of us can learn because all our lives are going to change. Sometimes it's tomorrow, sometimes it's 10 years from now, but our lives are going to change.
Well, and I think it also verifies what engineers will tell you, that every system is perfectly designed to give you the results you're getting.
Yes.
So how you engineer the incentives is precisely the outcome you're going to get. And if it's to get an ID on the test, you'll get that, but you may not get a student who can give you the same answer 3 months later. So that's exactly. Fascinating all by itself. Well, let's take it at the classroom level. Let's start there because you have some examples in the book of classroom teachers who are doing great things, who are, you know, and essentially breaking the mold, but coming up with different approaches just in how they teach in the classroom.
I'll use one that I did. Several years ago, I was teaching a class, and I handed out index cards to the students, and I said, 90 seconds, write on your index card who invented the printing press. And of course, in 2 seconds, they'd all written Gutenberg. I said, you can hand me that card right now, and you have an A for the class. You don't have to come. You don't have to do a single thing. And all the students were horrified. They knew it was a trick. And they said, well, what if we have the wrong answer? I said, well, then you fail. And they said, what do we do? I said, turn over the card and use any device you have. And now tell me, 90 seconds, who invented the printing press? Well, they worked so brilliantly, collaboratively, under that time pressure. And pretty soon they knew that the printing press was invented by Bi Sheng, a scholar in the Song Dynasty in China 400 years before Gutenberg invented the printing press, that it went to Korea, that it then went back to China. And then the invention of printing comes to the West along the Silk Road, along with spices and algebra and calculus and many other things that come to the West. And I said, so what have you just learned? And they said, we've learned that on our tests, we write Gutenberg and that education is lying to us.
Yeah.
I said, so that's a life lesson. Always double check and always think who is the source of knowledge and what knowledge you're getting. But it also put the source of knowledge in the hands of my student. And that was the most important thing. They weren't looking to me for an answer. They had to find an answer and they had to verify the answer. I also said they couldn't just go to Wikipedia. They had to find verifiable sources. They were able to do that. And so I think that's a really important lesson.
And collaboration, that's critical in your example as well. And we really don't promote that in the current system, do we?
It's very, very difficult. Everything about getting into college is about what you have achieved. But we also know from many management studies that the people who succeed best in business, even at Google, which is supposedly going to be, you know, focus on a certain kind of high-achieving STEM student, is about learning how to work with others. In fact, Google did an amazing study that came out just this past March called Project Aristotle, where they studied what made an effective team. And Google famously has what they call their A-teams. And it's the best person in each subfield. They're given a hard challenge, and they're supposed to compete and come up with something new. When they looked at all of Google's management data going all the way back to the beginning, almost no major invention had come out of the A teams. They came out of the B teams. And what defined a B team? You can say something stupid and no one says it's stupid. Somebody says, I don't agree with that, but let's build on it. They basically knew how to play well with others. There were no bullies. They weren't the best team, but those were the teams that lasted. They were also the teams that came up with the most brilliant ideas. That's something we can all learn in higher education, whether it's on the level of the classroom or on the level of departments, on the level of how we give people tenure. It's very hard to get tenure doing collaborative work. And there's lots of ways that scientists who do collaborative work give each other credit on articles so that people can still evaluate them as individuals.
Well, and at the student level, too, I mean, again, we have a set up a competitive process where you're grading on a curve. Grades count for everything. The highest grades get you into the next level, the grad school and whatever. And so it's hard to imagine that even if you had one or two collaborative projects along the way, that it's a collaborative experience getting through college, right?
Yeah. One of the saddest things in the book was I interviewed many, many students. And at the last page, so the positive thing is students really want to have an education, to have a better life, not just a better income, but a better life. And a better life is also a life in society, a life in a good society. But I interviewed somebody who had just graduated from Harvard, a stellar student who wanted to go on to get a JD PhD, a combined law degree with a PhD, and do good works the rest of his life. He's a great young man. And I said to him, tell me about your Harvard education. He loved it. I said, is there anything wrong? He said, yeah, I want to go on to get a JD PhD. And I was told very earlier, if I had a grade below an A, I would not be able to go on. He said, here I'm at this university where there was so many riches, so many things I could have taken advantage of. I don't care if I get a B, but if it means I can't have my dream and I can't do the things I want to do in the world, I can't take that chance. That's really, really sad. So it's not just about that we have to compete with each other. We compete against ourselves in a way that defeats us. I mean, Harvard could come up with pass credit courses. There are easy ways to make changes that aren't that revolutionary and that would make a difference in students' lives.
Well, the other point you make is that that kind of system also filters individuals who go to the top who are good at a very narrow spectrum of capabilities, and that some of the other capabilities, the ability to collaborate, the ability to be wrong for a little bit of time and then move on, which can benefit corporations greatly and the corporate social experience as well, they get filtered out because they've got an A-.
Absolutely. And sometimes they get filtered out even at the high school level. I mean, we no longer have vocational training as part of public high school systems. And many students who are good at all kinds of things that don't get tested on your on your SAT test fall by the wayside. Now, they are valuable people, and actually many of the occupations they have are not going to be outsourced or not going to be automated later on. Car mechanics are not going to be automated. You know, there are many, many things you can do that are worthwhile, but we have such a narrow filtering system on what counts as smart that we're actually harming our society. We're not taking advantage of all the brilliance that is available in our society.
Well, that brings us to the other point where you're talking about higher education, but shouldn't we start with K through 12 first?
I don't think K through 12 can change until higher education changes, because no middle-class parent wants to harm their child's prospects. And everybody knows, even though there's been lots of bad press about higher education doesn't mean as much anymore, having a degree changes what your possibilities are for the rest of your life. So until higher education is no longer a gatekeeper that limits and restricts what counts as somebody who's college ready, we're not going to be able to, responsible teachers aren't going to be able to change K through 12. And so I really think college has to change, be part of the movement and leading the movement towards change and say, no, we're looking for something different. That's also what happened at Hampshire. When they got rid of the SAT, ACT requirements, they received more applications from students who suddenly felt they could go to Hampshire, who were in fact more brilliant, but not more testably brilliant and more like the kind of student that Hampshire wanted. It's been a complete 100% success story for Hampshire.
Well, let's talk about the funding and how much it costs to go to colleges and universities. Would anything in these structural changes also change the prohibitive costs that are now part of a college education?
For private universities, I think that, you know, the sadness. I recently talked to a very, very important official at Harvard who said that one of the biggest problems at Harvard now is a majority of students who graduate from Harvard spend their careers tending the portfolios of other students who went to Harvard. And that's not good for anybody. It's not good for Harvard. It's not good for anybody. In fact, Charles Eliot, the great reformer of higher education, who was the president of Harvard for 40 years at the end of the late 19th century, he's the one responsible for our modern education system as much as any one person is, he and his friends. He invented the system of financial aid. Not because of noblesse oblige and he wanted to help poor people, but he knew that the typical Harvard student needed the competition and the intelligence and the different experience from people who weren't simply children of Harvard. That's almost replicated now, where it costs so much to go to our best universities that you're having a kind of insularity. A friend of mine calls it the velvet tunnel. You think you're seeing the world, you think you know the world, but what you're really knowing is a very comfortable tunnel that actually limits you. For public universities, for the last 40 years, we've seen a defunding of public universities. Yeah. And any parent who's worried about the cost of their child's tuition has to think about what they voted for in the last 40 years and who they voted for in the last 40 years, because this is terrible. We are putting a terrible, terrible tuition burden on our children that was not on most of us when we were going to college. If you're parent age, you went to college under a much saner system. Right now, the University of Colorado gets 3% of its funding from the state of Colorado.
Wow.
What does it come from now? Private sources, grants, but mostly tuition. And ironically, it comes partly from tuition from people who live outside of Colorado, having to pay out-of-state tuition to subsidize a public university system for the state. How can that be good for our futures? I mean, the thing I keep saying about higher education is it's not like the future looks great for any of us. We need young people who can figure out how to solve the problems that we've given them, that they've inherited from us.
Kathy Davidson, pay heed to these words. Kathy Davidson is the author of The New Education, How to Revolutionize the University to Prepare Students for a World in Flux. Also a professor and director of the Futures Initiative at the Graduate Center at City University of New York. Always great to have you on the show. Come back anytime.
I will be so happy to come back again, Frank. Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you. Tiff Merritt is with us next. She talks about her tour and her toddler. Stay tuned.